Good afternoon, everybody. My name is John Hamry. Delighted that you all are here. And this is going to be a very interesting afternoon. This is my first opportunity to welcome Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg to come back to CSIS as a solo compared to the last time he was here. And that was, of course, when he was the defense minister. And I can still remember that meeting, unlike a lot of meetings when you have visiting senior parliamentarians, there's usually a gentle sleeping sound in the room, you know. But not that time. There was energy and vigor and excitement. It struck me because this is a remarkably dynamic and interesting intellect who thinks quite broadly about modern Germany, modern Europe, the transatlantic relationship, the need to rethink this time we have together with the context of today, not the history of the past. You know, it's been very interesting, and we've enjoyed many conversations over the last year since he's relocated up into this country. He came down this morning, Nanook of the North, it was 2 feet of snow in Connecticut, and got the last train down here. Fortunately, no airplanes were flying from that, right? So we were glad for his persistence and delighted that he could be here. We look forward to his presentation, and we're going to have a very lively discussion with all of you, and so we look forward to that. Carl Theodor, let me ask you to come up, and we'll get this started. Thank you. Please welcome Carl Theodor zu Guttenberg.
I hope it works. Yes, it does. Thank you very much, John, for your most kind words. And I really made it this morning. It was half a meter of snow overnight, actually. And it was one of these experiences I've had during the last year, storm after storm. So we came here with Irene, and then we had the last winter storm in last October. And, of course, Sandy now, and yesterday this next snowstorm. So it's quite a remarkable experience for my family and me, being out of power for another 10 days, and we got power back last Tuesday, and after another 2 days, we had a snowstorm, so there's again no power. So it's highly romantic up in Connecticut, and it's great coming down here. It's a privilege and honor to speak here today, and after a year with CSIS, where I gained invaluable experiences, I'm just happy to have the opportunity just to refer to a couple of topics where I was working at within that year. What a fantastic place, due to your leadership, John. I would just like to praise you for that as well. And what a place to widen the horizon, on one hand, to have great discussions, really in depth on many, many things, and also, yes, to keep silent, which may have been a surprise for many. And to keep silent, to concentrate on topics where I didn't have the chance to dive into during the last couple of years, to concentrate on topics where I pretended, I wished, or maybe I missed to have knowledge so far in the political business. And in this regard, this year was a marvelous year for me, highly enjoyable, and I'm very grateful that I have the opportunity to be here. Also see a good number of esteemed German correspondents sitting here this afternoon. So if your expectation is that this would be a shrewd attempt of my side to launch a comeback here into the political arena, you might be terribly disappointed. And it's going to be probably a comparably boring afternoon for all of you, because all rumors you may have heard during the last couple of weeks regarding a swift return to the German political platform maybe I quote once in my lifetime Newt Gingrich, baloney. I'm just too happy here with my family, and I'm so much enjoying the time over here, and it's so maybe that's just important to say at this time. And so I hope that you have a relaxed afternoon in this regard, and this is no great news or whatever bad news for anybody, so I'm happy to be here. The elections are over, and so is the intellectually most inspiring period of campaigning. I was from time to time struck of how mild we treat each other, how mildly we treat each other in Germany when it comes to elections. A couple of things you don't want to learn when you're over here, and the style of the campaign as such was one I would not like to see in other places in Europe as well, although some things we have learned probably too. So what do we have to expect from a maybe renewed old president? From a European perspective, the good and bad news may be predictability. When it comes to transatlantic relations, it is a little bit more complex, and specifically after the last 4 years, but probably due to already a couple of decades we are talking about now, that we still cling to certain ways how to see the transatlantic relations without really gathering what has changed. Of course, the foreign policy community has probably heard more speeches about transatlantic relations than we have grains of sand on the shores of both sides of the Atlantic. And many of them are inspired by romantic, by nostalgic thoughts, and aside from relatively uninspired references to shared values and interests, there's still a propensity to state the unrivaled global influence of the so-called West. An astonishing hubris. Surprisingly enough, a notable number of manuscripts and also institutions still reflect on the after effects and effects of a mainly bipolar Cold War influenced world. What a remarkable ability to adapt to realities that have had their first turning point almost a quarter of a century ago. Certainly there is no reason to bore you with another tiring elaboration on the Anni Mirabili 1989 and 1990. And certainly the enumeration of the crucial dates 11/9 and 9/11 is familiar in the meanwhile. But they are neither synonyms nor parallels. The first date has been the rootstock of a significant global geopolitical shift. The other, as horrific as it was, serves less as a source for a new world order than as the poisonous blossom of a long time neglected, fast-growing plant that only partly has the same or similar roots. Although the significance of both dates is widely understood, many strategic answers, irrespectively whether they come from Europe or from the United States, are still comparably unsatisfactory, specifically regarding long-term perspectives. Some refer to these developments as moving from a symmetric world order to a new age of asymmetry and to the consequence of ad hoc solutions. Others refuse to bear the burden of a comprehensive and methodical stocktaking, not only of current and forthcoming global challenges, but also of their, and that's, I think, so important and so highly neglected, of their interdependencies, you have to see, and to realize. And this goes hand in hand with a tendency to avoid a thorough and unadorned debate about the consequences and culture of decision-making on both sides of the Atlantic. Let me only refer to the European side in this context, where I sometimes get the impression of a political leadership attitude that follows three principles. First, keep all options open, but do it decisively. Second, hesitate, but leave the impression of calculated shilly-shally. Third, be modest about any potential power, but humbly be convinced of having no such power. Not only therefore, the fundament for any long-term assessments or solutions is already porous, and the basis of any pillars of so-called grand strategies that are being discussed again and again of limited firmness. One slogan could be disconnection through connection. New intertwined global challenges and global shifts of power imply the risk of a marginalization of traditional partnerships and multinational institutions. And as the world grows together, it is also growing apart. Four major developments: global governance failure, the global shift of powers, global political awakening, and economic disparity between and within countries These four major topics influence the evolution of a variety of other global risks, and ironically, a considerable number of those risks can further magnify the four overarching developments I've just mentioned. What are the risk scenarios that have emerged or will evolve beyond the four cross-cutting global developments? CSIS is doing an excellent work on this specifically. I think we face at least five major risk clusters, which are tightly connected to each other, again intertwined, and often overlap into other clusters. First, geopolitical risks. Here we have been talking for years about fragile, failing, and failed states and the consequences ranging from terrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, illicit trade, organized crime, you name it, to piracy or even to corruption. Furthermore, this cluster includes all sorts of geopolitical conflicts. Besides classic scenarios and quotation marks, even such areas like space security. Secondly, economic risks. We clearly haven't seen the last crisis or a credible perspective of how to get a solution for the quagmire we're in right now. As results and reasons of these crises, one could only name, amongst others, asset price collapses, extreme currency and price volatilities, maybe on energies, commodities, or consumer prices, liquidity and credit crunches, infrastructure fragility, regulatory failures, etc. It's a vicious circle as long as we fail on both sides of the Atlantic to assess and understand the origins of more and more complex instruments and measures. Maybe derivative instruments, maybe interesting accounting methods, or other things. It sure is questionable whether this helps the developed countries in a short-term perspective, but it could indeed have a helpful impact on the developing world. It's in this context worthwhile to read, I think already a classic, because it has been published a couple of years ago, The Mystery of Capital of Hernando de Soto, because that really points to certain interconnections and phenomena I've just tried to mention. And let us also not underestimate a certain retrenchment from globalization going along with these phenomena, and a resurgence of nationalism and populism, sometimes extremism. In this regard, not only groups in Europe serve as a sallow, shining example. Third, societal risks. Here we have to take into account all challenges that are linked to demographic developments. It's still one of the most dramatically neglected issues on the other side of the Atlantic. The effects are enormous, as we know, regardless whether you look at them in Europe with their influence on beloved social security systems, or in other parts of the world with a contrary development, implying questions like energy, food, water security, as well as chronic, infectious, and in our hemisphere, so-called lifestyle diseases. It's quite interesting, public health expenditures in the OECD countries has risen at twice the rate of economic growth. And as Western society already undergoes a dramatic change in its age structure, some call it the age quake, the World Health Organization uses the phrase a silent social revolution, a silence that echoes political shyness and sometimes inabilities. And yes, even silence can have an echo. And we must not forget migration and the subsequent urban developments. And in the future, intercontinental migration will become increasingly important. Societal risks lead us to, fourth, environmental risks. I'm still surprised about the degree of ignorance, or let's put it a little bit more mildly, unawareness maybe, in high-level political circles in this country when it comes to the question and the after-effects of climate change. The election campaign gave us a good example of that again. Topics like biodiversity loss, melting of the polar ice caps, flooding, air pollution, waste management, a growing number of storms and cyclones also merit mention. And what it means then also in the question of how to link that to infrastructure is also one of the most shining examples I've had during the last year, realizing what worth the wire system in the United States, specifically at the East Coast, has. It's I've had the rather stupid idea to go to an official. That's a very German behavior, to go to an official at the town of Greenwich and ask them, "You're one of the richest towns in the United States. Have you ever thought about putting the wires underground?" That was I encountered, let's say, limited humor when it came to that question, and I keep working on it. But it's a big thing. Fifth and finally, technological risks. Cyber war is as much a reality as the threats from new technologies are, certainly without denying the chances. Risks even include the invisible threat of immaterial environmental pollution. All this is no Buck Rogers or Star Trek fantasy any longer. The chances of a critical information infrastructure breakdown have not been significantly reduced during the last couple of years. Everyone in this room, of course, recalls the year 2007 and Estonia. But it has been forgotten in many, many other circles, and how easy it is just to shut off more or less a whole country as such. May have produced a romantic night for Estonia, and maybe the birth rate was a little bit higher 9 months later. But the after effects were rather significant, and it's good. It should have been a wake-up call. It unfortunately wasn't, in to the extent you could actually expect it. Online data and information security is a mega topic nowadays, and so are the paradoxa that go along with the call for freedom of the internet on one hand and the criminal misuse of the internet on the other hand. And we see the triumph of open networks, which is a great thing, but with major complexities that are almost impossible to control responsibly for those who want to. So indeed, this is an incomplete list, though it still shows the range of challenges we are facing today and tomorrow. Sure, none of the challenges are new for any of you here, but there is almost no valuable political attempt to deal again with the interconnecting lines within and between the clusters. I had experienced that we sometimes tend in the political world to consider causes of certain things and interdependencies as synonyms. And it's good to make a distinction here. So what has the transatlantic community to offer when it comes to the question of how to get a firm grip on these intertwining lines? Generally, we could find quite a spectrum of possible measures if more and explicitly coordinated efforts were to take place. But do we see anything inspiring, anything creative in a political, academic, or cultural arena that aims at the challenges mentioned above? Not much, I'm afraid. Some are working hard on it. This think tank is one of them. Nonetheless, it is necessary to assess the epicenter of the transatlantic relationship first, and it may sound simplistic. It's the people on both sides of the Atlantic. However, a new generation of policymakers, of scholars, and also commentators shows a changed attitude and approach towards the Atlantic connection. One reason is that the background and the scope of experiences of many has changed, or is at least in an evolutionary phase. In contrast to the second half of the 20th century, many young, influential Americans have never been based or stationed in Europe, for instance. A growing number has a Latin American or an Asian background. And think about the students of today in Europe. Many of them were born after 1989, so they never have had the existential experience of what it meant to live in a surrounding that urgently needed a functioning transatlantic partnership. And imagine their upbringing and environment. A good number comes from the former east of Europe, others are second or first generations Europeans originating from Turkey or North Africa with different cultural roots. All this is not problematic at all. On the contrary, it is enriching and a source of inspiration. But it has to be understood, it has to be clearly understood and accepted when it comes to a new definition of transatlantic ties. Secondly, amongst the younger generation, pragmatism seems to replace emotions. Superficially, this finding is not a political disaster, but rather influences the value-driven approach that we have used for so many decades to the relationship as such. Ask someone younger about these values and you still get the answers, see, rule of law, democracy, and human rights, which is absolutely correct. but ask the same person how these principles correspond across the Atlantic or to what extent they are implemented at home, and you may get a fascinating wild mixture of imprecise semi-intellectual sound bites. A clear response would have to imply uncomfortable considerations like aspects of a democracy crisis that we face nowadays in certain parts of the Western world. Additionally, negative emotions seem to function quite properly across the ocean. Positive sentiments are rarely and if routinely expressed. The last outstanding transatlantic hope and expectation from the European side has just been re-elected 2 nights ago. But it was a hope tied to a character and not to a traditional political or cultural construct. Today it seems that many Europeans turned their dreams into, if not disillusion, but at least in a perception that this American president is a human being and not a godlike figure. Though shrinking to a rather normal chap with all talents and fallibilities can be a wonderful thing, and I know what I'm talking about, it's worthwhile to look at the European perception of Mitt Romney as well. It showed our unbeaten possibilities to give someone the most charming status of a hideous demon. And for my American friends, Democrats and Republicans, it is hard to understand why more than 90% of the Germans would have happily voted for Obama. That's a truism, actually, from a German perspective, and it is a truism in the meanwhile over here that you have a split country in this regard. But it shows again how far we are apart in certain ways of thinking. However, the European foreign policy community is more critical. When it comes to the current president, some draw the conclusion that an internationally celebrated political rock star turned out to be a one-time Grammy winner, respectively Nobel Prize winner, at least on the diplomatic platform. Nevertheless, in respect of foreign affairs capacities, the campaign as such did not offer more insights how it would have been on the other side as well. But what we see is a very promising outlook for a flourishing transatlantic perspective. What is left of the myth of existing transnational institutions? What is left of a creative transatlantic influence on the substance and structure of other international organizations? First, NATO. The alliance has been struggling to adapt to the new security challenges for years and has only selectively widened its scope. Cyber war, energy scarcity may serve as examples, though they have not efficiently been implemented yet. National interests traditionally perform as impressive roadblocks in this regard. And the Libya operation of last year, by the way, and despite all songs of praise we have heard, is no more a NATO success if you take the decision-making behavior of important member states into account. What, by the way, will happen to NATO and with NATO when the demographic developments in parts of Europe hit the alliance? Our discussions about GDP percentages will probably be history then. Just a word about Afghanistan, where I've been numerous times. NATO can never win in Afghanistan, and the remaining chance of not losing it may have been sacrificed on a silver tray to accommodate the mood of the voters at home. If I had to define cynicism to my children, I would start with Afghanistan's perspectives. We've tried hard. NATO has tried hard. The soldiers are doing a credible job down there. But the perspectives are not too great at the very moment. Secondly, the United Nations. I know the Americans just love the United Nations. Certain structures of the United Nations remind me of an iceberg drifting into waters with unpredictable warm currents, while the journey of the iceberg started in 1949. However, beneath the iceberg, a rather stable raft appears, unfortunately with only 5 admittedly quite comfortable seats. The only recognizable transatlantic structural attempts to expand the raft are monuments of standstill and stagnation, artistically inspired by France, the UK, and, yes, the US. And a monument that knowingly attracts China and Russia as well. And not only desperate Syrian hands slide off the slick side planks of the raft. Thirdly, the EU. I don't want to elaborate in detail on the European crisis. We can maybe do that in the discussion afterwards. And to talk about Europe, I also would like to say it's such a pleasure to work with you, Heather, here, the director for the European program at CSIS. She's doing an amazing job in this regard in quite rough years at the very moment. It's worth an own speech, of course, but the current crisis, which is not only a debt crisis or fiscal crisis, but also a structural crisis and one of understanding, and therefore still a crisis of leadership, is destabilizing the core concept of the European Union as well. I'm deeply concerned about the future of the achievements of the European Union, achievements that too many people in Europe just take for granted. Needless to say, such a crisis has spillover effects for the transatlantic partnership, and it strengthens our ominous culture of mutual finger-pointing. Finally, even organizations with more limited, though significant, scopes are struggling, just to name the OECD or WTO. Somehow logical, loser concepts like the G20 are gaining ground. But if one tries to remember what were the outcomes, for instance, of the last two G20 meetings, it may be due to my really bad memory I have, but there's not much more than the family photos I have in mind. So if we think about Cannes and the very nice setting, or even Los Cabos in Mexico, it's hard to get a grip on that too. So some traditional multi or transnational frameworks and concepts could be considered or could suddenly find themselves on the verge of decay. So does the transatlantic community offer any viable answers? I doubt it. Do we understand the paradox that the circumstances which make better global governments imperative are also the ones that make its realization so incredibly complex and often unpleasant? I doubt it as well. So eventually, what are the consequences for Europe and the US? Will the transatlantic relationship remain a core element of Western political influence, or is it in agony because of a Pacific and Asian 21st century? Can the undoubtedly growing Trans-Pacific importance, the pivot to Asia, be an excuse at all? By no means. It may be one out of many more or less good reasons, but it is also a cheap plea. So what to do? What are possible steps to avoid a sidelining of the Atlantic perspectives? Accepting a new dynamic of multipolarity may sound difficult, for many of my friends over here, by the way, but it's essential. The same is true for the understanding that global stability can be promoted and progressed only through larger scale cooperation and not through imperial behavior or domination. I quote Zbigniew Brzezinski here, who wrote a most interesting book just a couple of months ago, one that's worthwhile fighting and a good discussion, but he's exactly right with that point. In any case, Europe has to accept Trans-Pacific ambitions and should enlarge its own strategic scope. On the other hand, the US could acknowledge the possibilities of closer responsible relations of the Europe to the East, including Russia, by the way. And that would mean, at the end of the day, so maybe more Pacific but not less Europe for this side over here. And on the other side, maybe more outreach towards redefined or newly defined partnerships, but not less America. Both does not necessarily weaken transatlantic relations. On the contrary, it could offer opportunities for stronger common strategic approaches and for revisions of certain, sometimes archaic, instruments or strategies. Just to mention the European Security Strategy, which is still from the year 2003, remarkably enough. In a mid- to long-term perspective, a broader cooperation between the so-called Old West and the New East doesn't have to be a daydream any longer. And we could mutually benefit from respective impulses and experience by fostering a regional cooperative model in a multipolar and increasingly complex geopolitical setting. And let us also frame the transatlantic area in a wider sense. Some think tanks and institutions in Washington rightly include Latin America and African countries that are linked to the same challenge clusters. There's, for instance, Atlantic Basin Initiative at Johns Hopkins University at ZEISS, I think, which points to the right direction. The German Marshall Fund has widened its scope as well, has had one of the last conferences in Morocco. I think those are the signals we need at the very moment. And even without this outreach, we always come back to one point that is connected to the economy. And the trade numbers, all of you probably know, are still one of the most remarkable ones when it comes to transatlantic relation. We totaled an estimate of $632 billion in 2011. 14 million people are employed directly in the transatlantic economy. And U.S. service exports to the EU is more than 40% of its total service exports and growing. So it would be more than welcome if the old new president, or the new old, or the aged president, or whatever we call him, declared early his intention to move forward with the European allies to launch an ambitious 21st century transatlantic economic agreement to get rid of non-tariff barriers and to open markets across the Atlantic. Such a strong message, on the other hand, will no doubt help European leaders explain to their unwilling and growingly unwilling public why it too will have to do more or strengthen the relationship to take a more courageous approach to security and defense, in particular in its neighborhood. And I just wonder whether the 90% that embraced Obama in Germany actually ever thought about the occurring demands for the next years to come, specifically regarding these points. Some romanticism might shrink them. And one only has to imagine what discussion we would have had in Germany, or we would have in Germany, with someone coming from the other camp over here. Would have been interesting. In addition, a bold and long-term strategic vision for the transatlantic community needs to reinvigorate the transatlantic relationship by promoting a global democratic political culture while strictly respecting specific cultural aspects. There are also distinctions on both sides of the Atlantic, how we deal with that. And this is not necessarily a contradiction. But we also have to engage in a self-critical debate about the state of democracy led by democratic countries. Existing rifts in this context are not insurmountable. Regarding the risk clusters that I have described, we must confront our publics with the truth and not with shimmering party and election programs. Looking at the United States, a new grand strategy should offer more than an accumulation of unfinished diplomatic bits and pieces. The good news is that the second term of Obama offers the opportunity to erase many question marks we have had in international community during the last couple of years. For example, an opportunity to give us an impression where the connecting lines between the president's Cairo speech, you may remember it, and the present Middle East policies are. Where is the rationality besides ad hoc procedures? Of course, the same questions have to be asked with respect to the European Union's foreign policy approaches. Europe's role, let's do it for the member states, but also for the European Union as such, in the foreign aftermath of the so-called Arab Spring, was all in all also not an experience of enlightenment. And there have been good approaches in the aftermath by the EU, by others, but it's still room for improvement. And to be fair, of course, governments will probably never resolve the dilemma between short-term thinking and the obligation to think in longer strategic terms, and also to firmly undergo explanatory work, which you need to do as well. They usually have to concentrate on the more immediate conflicts and disagreements. But this doesn't exclude the willingness to form groups and initiatives that include knowledge, experience, but also young ideas that range from academia to culture and to those people who tend to see themselves in a complementary role. All this only can happen if traditions continue to develop and contribute to the diversity instead of seeking a uniform global culture. One may call it the expansion of tradition. Some thoughts that such groups or initiatives would have to cover are more than obvious for me. Regarding the span of the global risks and challenges, sure, A well-informed and well-mobilized global public opinion sounds great. Sharing values and norms of a global citizenship sounds equally great. But it's still closer to utopia than to realization. Notwithstanding, in this context, the modern means of digital communication could be used much more creatively. And this is an experience I have from my time in parliament and in government as well. We could have done more in this regard. And we could try to understand a little bit more what kind of shift of power is taking place in this field as well already. When we talk about information gathering, we don't really talk about the classic national governments. We talk about the private sector in the meanwhile. And the question is, do we have a concept for that? I think we have to work on that rather intensely. By accepting the differences, we need to work on our cultural ties. We tend to underestimate them, and they have, as stated, significantly changed. And the US administration needs to understand that the European Union is a work in progress, a tectonic process that still has the potential to produce a stronger, more viable friend and ally. Nonetheless, decision makers in the US, and for that matter in Europe, need patience and perseverance, as the value of the Lisbon Treaty is not comparable to the achievements in America between 1776 and 1791. And two rather banal aspects are essential. First, we need to bridge the existing uncertainty amongst rising powers to shoulder a greater share of global responsibilities. Secondly, the established powers have to surmount their reluctance to recognize the limits of their own power. And we have to reach out way past the old West, engaging China, Russia, but also Brazil, India, or South Africa, and Indonesia, and others is key. And some European governments still have credibility in areas where the reputation of the United States, let's say diplomatically at least, it's strained. Not only the transatlantic relationship needs a new narrative, and that's a word that comes again and again, we need a new narrative here and we need a new narrative there, but it's quite true. Also the institutions, such as the EU, such as NATO, such as the United Nations, because we won't achieve any long-lasting changes without giving our population the opportunity to understand and to accept certain obvious complexities and dilemmas. Such a transatlantic community could serve as a pulse generator, as a source of inspiration, instead a source for strategic despair. To conclude, I think we need to show both pragmatism and still emotions. Pragmatism without emotion hamstrings creativity, and of course uncontrolled emotions have led to historic conflicts already. I propose to accept connection through disconnection, or you put it the other way around, disconnection through connection, and maybe to strive for an emotional pragmatism. The transatlantic relationship deserves a serious endeavor to attain it. Thank you very much, and I'm very much looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you so much, and good afternoon again, and welcome. My name is Heather Conley. I'm the Senior Fellow and Director of the Europe Program, and have had the equal privilege of working with Carl Theodor this year. He has helped me understand Europe a bit more and understand the challenges, and that was an extraordinarily sweeping framework of how to rethink the transatlantic relationship, and thank you. I was writing notes and have many questions, and I'm sure you were doing the same, and I know have many questions. So I would love to, with your permission, jump right in.
Absolutely.
And give you a good grilling for the next 45 minutes or
so. Talk longer.
I'm going to ask a few questions to get the ball rolling, but really want to turn to you for a good discussion with our audience. I'm going to make you focus back on Germany a little bit, if you don't mind, and then expand out a bit more transatlantically. We at CSAS have been attempting to keep up with the tectonic shifts, the realignment that is occurring in Europe today. And I think last evening's meeting between Chancellor Merkel and Prime Minister Cameron was a perfect example of that potential realignment. Karl Tanner, help us understand the role of Germany within Europe, looking ahead through the next 10 years. We often hear Chancellor Merkel talking about more Europe. The answer to the crisis is more Europe. I have struggled with understanding exactly what that concept is. And maybe you'd like to offer your thoughts when we get to the question and answer period. But help me understand German attitudes and its role as it works through what I consider to be Europe's greatest and most significant existential crisis since the Second World War.
Thank you very much, Heather. I think that Germany comes from a remarkably strong position at the moment while still somehow denying the strength when it comes to domestic politics in Germany, because that leaves much more room to maneuver. The expectations towards Germany are huge, and they are huge from more or less all partners in the meanwhile within the European Union. That was not always the case, and that may be due to the fact that we have had some significant changes in government, specifically in our Western neighborhood. It may be due to the fact of the economic struggles of many, although we never can exclude sliding into struggles as well. The last export numbers we've heard from Germany were not too comforting in this regard, and of course export was part of the success story within Europe. We've been blamed for that again and again, also from this side over here. It may have been helpful maybe at a certain time also to address the European public or to openly say that Germany has profited also from the development of other European countries. I think it would make the understanding of unavoidable sacrifices the German public has to face in the next years to come much easier. The second point I'd like to make when it comes to the role of Germany is it will be an understandable role going further than this one sentence which I underline, but which is as vague as you have just stated it. It would be an easier way to understand Germany if we would be capable and able to cut down the complexities of the situation we are in right now into not only sound bites, but into pictures that the people in Europe understand. There is, and I've done the same, there is a certain tendency and temptation to hide behind the complexities. So, and that's not a thing I would blame the German government for. That's at the very moment probably true for many, many institutions and governments in Europe, that if you make a couple of 170-degree turns within the complexity, neither the media nor the people nor others really understand what's going on. It's 170-degree turns because with 280-degree turns you would land specifically at the spot again, but it leaves you room to maneuver within. So complexity is one factor, and the other factor, yes, the expectations. It's an old saying, well, it's an old thing we've been discussing here for years and years. How do the Germans deal with the expectation of leadership? And the term leadership is a problematic term as you translate it into German. This is well known, and we are still lingering around there. And the question is, do we accept a responsible leadership role? And I would say, yes, we have to. Or are we more or less swimming, which the Chancellor doesn't do, but which others do, between a culture of restraint or even reluctance? And that doesn't help Europe at all. Last point of Germany's role, I don't see anybody else than Germany right now to get a grip on the structural deficits we have in the European Union. Of course you need all member states to change a treaty, but we have to face the realities. And the realities are not only the ones starting with the monetary union. The realities are the different speeds we faced since the 50s of the last century. And conceptually, I think there could be more. The question is, does it really fit into election expectations? Does it really fit into the calendar of, let's say, four-year terms and other things? And so I somehow fear that in the European Union as such that we will muddle through for many years to come.
One last question, I promise we'll turn it over to our audience. Your comments on Afghanistan, and I remember when you were first appointed as defense minister, Kunduz happened. It was an extraordinary tragedy. It was an awakening of Germany's role in Afghanistan. As NATO forces and coalition forces transition in 2014, what lessons will Germany take from that experience? How has it changed Germany's defense and security posture? And help put that comment into context of why Germany decided not to support the Libya operation.
Well, the latter you have to ask those who made the decision. And I have repeatedly stated, although I'm not saying very much over here on German politics as such, and I haven't done this during the last year, but a couple of months ago I said that I was definitely not in line with that very decision that has been made there. And I said it before, I think it really harmed NATO more than we were not alone, others were there as well, but it put it even more at risk probably. On Afghanistan, what are the lessons learned? I hope that one lesson learned might be never ever put dates into the discussions. Because I think that will be one of the points where we will see the results, and these results will not only be positive ones. The second one, of course, is that we have significantly changed our scope on our armed forces, the way we might be involved in conflicts which are not measurable any longer the traditional way, and that we had to change the Bundeswehr but also strategic thinking in Germany into a much more flexible and much more creatively positioned institution as such, probably. And that makes it still hard, because it's a lesson which continuously needs to be transmitted to the public. And the German public will never be in favor, of course nobody can blame them for that, for it never be in favor to be involved in military conflicts, maybe with the exception when it comes to humanitarian aid. But the change that's taking place now, when we talk about flexibility, we talk about more and more as well about unhealthy topics like maybe special forces, maybe new devices like drones, maybe of course, training measures in parts of the world where you never would have expected a German soldier standing. But that will be the reality for the next years to come. And I think we're in a good way here. And this current government has done a great job there. And after my resignation. I think they're still on the right path here, but they must not stop explaining the realities to the German public.
Thank you. Well, let's bring you into the conversation. We have microphones, and if you'd please state your name and your affiliation, and just to remind all of our colleagues, this is an on-the-record conversation, and I see a hand right there, so if we could have a microphone, please. Coming? Oh, I'm sorry. Right there. Thank you, Heliki.
Jakob Schroth, I'm a student at the American University. Mr. zu Guttenberg, thank you very much for your remarks and about your perspective on transatlantic relations. I especially enjoyed one point you mentioned, the younger generations on both sides of the Atlantic. There, and the current study, Transatlantic Trends, from the German Marshall Fund, it says that 75% of the younger generation in America between 18 and 24 says that Southeast Asia is the most important partner for them, mm-hmm. while two-thirds of Americans over the age of 60 says it's definitely Europe. Mm-hmm. And so we see that there's a decreasing amount of students in America in high school who are learning German in school. We have problems funding the exchange programs in Germany for America, even the Bundestag Congress exchange program. So what would you suggest, how can we strengthen the transatlantic partnership, especially in the younger generation, to ensure that there is an ongoing process of understanding? Thank you.
Great question.
Thank you. That's a great question. Of course, there are many existing programs, but it is harder and harder to attract young people on both sides of the Atlantic to get involved in an exchange on topics that are not very precisely framed. I think we have to be more concrete and more precise when it comes to the topics where we try to get the young people together. So part of our initiative now will be, for instance, here, the initiative which is connected to my work I'm doing here, is that we seek for global leaders that are connected to the risk clusters I've just mentioned before, but not only the well-known names, but also to excellent younger people that stand for ideas and that stand for probably also the shift of power I've mentioned before in the IT world and other parts, to discuss the relevance for themselves, but also for the transatlantic partnership. And I think we have to give more give more the chance to get the impulses from the younger generation than imposing our impulses on them. So this is one of the things I have recognized again and again, and I was flying back and forth when I was in Bundestag, because I was trying to work a little bit on the transatlantic relations. We could have done much more to just allow even funky ideas from the younger generation to be part of our conversations. But when it came to the question, for instance, of climate change, there was like a big wall in between the two camps of both sides of the Atlantic. When it, on the other hand, came in the early years to topics like cybersecurity, you had big eyes from the European side, what the hell is this? Yeah? And we have never had the minds with us and people coming from that very angle that first of all spoke the language of the younger people, that were able also to conduct a discussion in that. And then maybe we have also to shift in more and more into platforms that are being used by the younger people. So of course one feels tempted coming from the political fields to write an op-ed for one of the big papers. Great. But you can be quite sure that it will not be realized by all too many from the younger. So a bit more of openness there as well. That's just a couple of points, and it needs to be elaborated, but that will be part of our program here. So whenever we do the dialogues here, whenever we will do interviews which we are planning, and they won't take place only here, but we will also reach out to other places where we can find the people and grab them, we will put them on the webpage. We will try to foster a discussion there, and not only in the room. And the people we invite into the room will be mainly young people, and to see where the impulses come from there. So this is maybe just another example.
Wonderful. Yes, please. I have a question in the back. We can take both of them if you'd like. You're right beside each
absolutely.
Other.
Thank you very much for these very thoughtful remarks. I'm Wolf Brookman. I'm with the American Chamber of Commerce in Germany, based here in Washington. I thought I might ask you about a major theme of President Obama during his recent campaign, and that was to bring manufacturing jobs home and to keep manufacturing jobs in the United States. Many people feel the German experience may be relevant to those questions. What advice would you give President Obama in this regard?
Great. You just want to pass the microphone, right? Can we just
take absolutely,
the two questions? Mm-hmm. Thank you both. Yeah, perfect. Brian
Beery, Washington correspondent for Europolitics newspaper. A question about the European defense sector at the moment. What do you think of the recent collapsed merger between BAE and EADS? Mm. I know there were media reports that Chancellor Merkel had vetoed it. Worries about Germany getting too close to, you know, U.S. defense contracting. What's your opinion about whether that was a missed opportunity to create some kind of a European equivalent in the defense sector, say, of Airbus in the civil aviation sector?
Yeah, that was one of the points. Thank you very much for your question. It was one of the points where I couldn't keep silent. Because I really see it as a missed opportunity. We talk a lot, and we talked a lot about the necessity of pooling and sharing in the European defense sector. We talked a lot about finding European solution for more and more complex settings we are in and other things. And then suddenly a window of opportunity creakingly opens, and then I found it, to put it mildly, surprising that it was Germany that was at the end of the day responsible for not making it possible. And I haven't heard any other viable arguments yet that it would that it happened any differently. So I talked to a couple of people as well, and I think the press reports about that were rather correct. Nevertheless, it's maybe also a chance for lessons learned, although it's not a very it's not a very promising outlook at the very moment. There might be another attempt. Let's see how it will be created and how it will be done. And what I also said, I think it would have been in the interest of the United States as well, although many told me you're entirely wrong. Of course, there would be a significant competitive factor in this regard. But on the other hand, it would raise a point which is so important for the next years to come, and this is how to strengthen the European pillar of whatever defense and military structures we would like to keep across the Atlantic. And under those circumstances, I think it would have been in mutual interest on both sides of the Atlantic. So I'm critical about that very outcome, and I would have liked to see it differently happening. Mr. Brookman, on bringing manufacturing jobs home, yeah, that's it. I had difficulties to really understand the substance of that key phrase, and of course, it's certainly not me to give any advice in this regard, and I would never dare to do that. I try to come from another angle. The German experience and the German development in the in let's say keep manufacturing jobs at home is also a very mixed one. It's not as easy as some pretend to see it as such. You certainly don't, but it is a development over many, many decades where we concentrated on key sectors of the economy, where we said, well, of course, there we do have a chance, and where we at the same time built up a, let's say, a sound framework for medium and small-sized companies, which is, I think, different to the one we find over here. So I would always see that as a necessary first step. There were lots of talks in that during the campaign. But fostering and strengthening the small and medium-sized company sector as such would be a necessary step to do so. I do see a chance in the... And this is a very difficult question for us Europeans as well. I do see a chance in the question of becoming independent in the energy sector. There you certainly talk about bringing home jobs in this regard as well. And I don't see much opportunities from our side of how to face that. I wouldn't say competition, it isn't another competition, but of how to face that situation which might evolve out of that.
Fantastic. Lots of questions from this side of the room. I think I'll take the one back over there, two together. Thank you.
Cvitan Chulimanov, Macedonian Information Agency. I would like to ask your views on our expectations in the term of in this current new term of President Obama on the EU and NATO enlargement. This was very long seen as in the case of the EU, a great success story, and sometimes some would say in the case of NATO, as the main reason for its existence. But in terms of Turkey, Ukraine, and Georgia, this has completely stopped, and even what should have been the easy work, the Balkan countries, it is also agonizing and protracted. So normally we see it as a lack of focus on part of Washington, and yes, Berlin, to that has allowed, in our case, countries like Germany, like Greece, to completely hijack the process. Do you see that this can be restarted?
Great. I think we'll just take that second question right behind there, please.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Heidi Maurer. I'm Austrian Marshall Fund Fellow at the Center of Transatlantic Relations here at SAIS. I would ask two questions, but very precisely. The first one would go back to what you mentioned about the European security strategy. And from my idea in Brussels, what I hear a lot is actually that we need a new document. But what I was wondering, and I would be very appreciate your opinion on this, where to look for this opinion. So who do you think is capable in the different structures to actually come up with an innovative document in this regard, also to give clear priorities that all member states could agree on? Then my second question comes back to the first question that we were actually discussing in terms of the role of Germany. And I would like to push it a bit more in the future to next year, because what I'm wondering a lot as a non-German, what to expect from the German elections and its impact on the discourse about European integration. So not so much of who might win the elections, but about the German discourse in terms of fighting an election and how this will impact on European integration. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. I think the discourse, but that's a perspective from now, will be not as rough as some expected, because we do have two candidates we know now. It's Per Steinbrück and Chancellor Merkel. And both are not significantly far away from each other when it comes to the general opinion of how to proceed. And I think it would be lousy tactics for either side to more or less unelegantly shift the gears. And so I expect it as being a campaigning issue that more or less relies on the question, does something significantly happen within this year? So do we come again closer to a default question? Do we again come closer to maybe another candidate being in question of being in the necessity of a bailout? So I just follow with some interest at the moment the discussions about France, where there obviously are some worries of how this development goes on. And so if such an occasion occurs, of course it's always easier for an opposition to say, why hasn't the government, which is perceived as being the strong factor in Europe, we talked about that before, why hasn't it been capable of finding a valuable solution? I think, again, that the topic will be hard to deliver out of the reason I've stated before. As long as the public doesn't get the opportunity to really understand what's going on, you will all very often find a strategy to somehow kick the can around the corner, but still kick it down the road. And so that's probably my expectations when it comes to the election. I don't think it will be a matter of credibility for any competitor of the chancellor if it could be proven that he or she, at the moment it's a he, has been in line for the last years and even a factor of certain decisions in the Grand Coalition, and then suddenly shifts to the other direction. Last point, I wouldn't exclude a certain tendency of some players, I wouldn't mention them, towards a Grand Coalition. And such a thing has to function at the end of the day as well. So maybe some will see that also as a reason for how to behave then. On the European security strategy and the new document, well, I would certainly underline that an attempt to do so. I think one thing has to be stated first before we talk about characters who could do that. And that's And that's one of the things some people keep asking for in Germany as well, to have a document which is not carved in stone and stands there as a monolithic block for the next years to come, but which is flexible enough to be readapted again and again. One can certainly argue about the substance of the National Security Study here in the United States of the NSS, but the good thing about it is it's been rewritten every 2 years. And so it forces the key players to cope with the dynamics we are in the meanwhile, on the global circus. I somehow sense that your question also was directed to, well, now we have a European foreign policy institution, and don't we need, let's say, characters on top that are being recognized a little bit more? Well, it's a hard process they are going through at the very moment, and finding a common foreign policy and a security strategy as such with 27 member states who claim to have their foreign policy as one of their rootstocks, of their understanding within the political sphere, is still a hard thing to do. But I have to admit it is certainly still a task to explain to the European public who Herman Van Rompuy and Cathy Ashton are. They're well known and do a great job in the professional sphere. But I just asked a couple of weeks ago when I was in Germany, someone talked to me in the street, and then just because I had a discussion in the morning, I asked the gentleman whether he knows who Ashton and Van Rompuy are. And then he said, yes, of course, the Formula One drivers. Yeah, and so it's maybe a poor example, but it shows that there is certainly room for improvement as well. And on EU-NATO enlargement, that's a tough one, because I think it has been put asleep quite sophisticatedly, that very question. And I certainly would still stick to the Thessaloniki goals, for instance. I think they are still viable. I certainly also would say that if we want to cope in the future with the asymmetric parts of the threats we are dealing, a certain way of enlarging NATO, maybe with full partnerships or other partnerships or memberships, is still a thing we need to have on the agenda. It's otherwise we will, in my opinion, undermine NATO structures as such. But we also have had the experiences, and there we have to be clear, of premature steps. And steps where the expectations were high and where we promised things with the connection to the dream of, well, they will, if they have the promise, they will certainly change within the country and to become a wonderful example of a functioning democracy and closer to the values than ever. So with some countries it has been obviously rather hard, just to mention the Ukraine, for instance, where not everybody is happy about the developments of the last couple of months or 1.5 years as such. And so I think we have to be more precise. We have to come down to measurements which you can easily read and easily not readapt the whole time, but which are clear. And on Turkey, you have to bridge two situations in the meanwhile. One is the grown self-understanding of Turkey, which has done a remarkable and great job during the last couple of years of developing a strong, strong position in the wider region down there. And the second thing is the the perception of many, many people in Turkey towards Europe. So the enthusiasm is was somehow understandably shrinking during the last couple of years, looking at the mess we are in right now. So the numbers I read, they differ a little bit from time to time, between sometimes 25 or even up to still almost 40%, but they're definitely not close to the 70-75% we have seen already of approval in Turkey of joining the European Union. Keeping the options open is the right approach, But I think it's not only a European question whether Turkey will become a member at the end of the day. It's in the meanwhile also a question of Turkish pride, Turkish self-understanding, and fostering its role in the region. And I think that we have to see.
Kater, if I could just pull one question from that. Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan was in Berlin, and he gave a date. He said Turkey needs to enter the EU by 2023. Do you think politically Germany feels that that date could be achieved? So that's one question. And then on the NATO question, you've been through a lot of NATO defense ministerial meetings and understand that. What is NATO's greatest task looking forward? What must it accomplish for it to remain vibrant and robust and relevant?
On your last point, and that is linked to the question we have heard before on EADS and BAE and other things, it's clearly the willingness to jump, as we say in German, to jump over your own shadow or your own shade, and to be willing to share. And to it's an old thing. We were talking about this since a couple of decades, to avoid duplications, et cetera, but to come with that step to more flexible and easier solutions of how to be swiftly and fastly in a position to act and to react. First thing. Secondly, as long as we do not allow a really functioning and not only in wording produced connection between the political discussion and the technical discussion, I think we won't come further. And it's that's a banality, but my experience is in sitting I'm not allowed to go into details, but in sitting in these circles and the lack of flexibility when it came to the core political discussions was marvelous. And so I think it's still one of these core points we need to see here as well. And the first point was on
Prime Minister Erdogan, while in Berlin, said 2023. Is that would the German public support Turkey entering the EU in 2020 by 2023? Sorry, a little tough.
If you'd ask the German public, they probably would have a majority that says no, probably. But it's one thing is public perception. The other one is the question again and again of political leadership of how to drive forward a certain thing. Well, it's I would have chosen the same tactics and strategy from Erdogan's side, and I didn't see the press conference, but I just saw a photograph, and the expression of Angela Merkel's face when he was standing next to her gave me at least an idea of how balanced the whole talk and everything was. So I just doubt whether we will even come to that point. And of course he has to keep it bubbling under the surface, but I don't think that he will scratch the surface yet and to let it out.
Yeah. I think we have time. Wow. I think we're going to bundle a couple of questions and then let you have the final say. So I'm going to begin, and we're going to work our way across with those hands. So keep them up, and please.
Mike Masetic with the PBS Online NewsHour. You mentioned demography. Do you have any suggestions, or do any European politicians really grasp this question of how they're going to deal with their demographic time bomb? I saw an interesting study by the European Institute that the European countries that have population growth, people, young women having babies, are France and Sweden, where they provide a lot of state support so women can have children but continue their professional lives and work outside the home, whereas the more patriarchal societies have the much lower birth rate. But the bottom line is there are just not enough children, and when are European political leaders going to talk about this in a candid way?
Thank you. We'll go right up here to the front and then to the second row.
Christoph von Marshall from the German daily Der Tagesspiegel. I would like to come back to the question of the pivot to the Pacific and how we deal with Asia, China, and generally. This idea, which you mentioned, has been floating around already for a few years, that we shouldn't individually talk to China. There should be a common approach, how we integrate China in a global system of responsibility. So my question would be just the other way around. Why is it not happening? It seems so logical. It seems so convincing. It has been around the idea. So what is the obstacle? Are we competitors too much? Do we have different approaches? One strategy, the other one wants to sell cars and other stuff? Or what's your idea why it's not happening?
Terrific.
Or why we have so little progress?
Thank you. And then we'll get Steve, and then we'll go.
Thanks. Kaltiro, Stephen Flanagan from CSIS. I wanted to come back to your comments. You alluded to Turkey's role in the Middle East. And you also talked about President Obama's speech in Cairo. How do you assess the European and American record vis-a-vis the Arab awakening? And what about the prospect for working together and with Turkey in promoting positive change in the broader Middle East? What scope do you see for that?
Go right back there.
Hi, I'm Linnea Kreibum. I'm a graduate student at the George Washington University, and I have a question. You mentioned the importance of improving political communication for the internet age. Could you go more into detail what you think that could look like, especially in Germany? Do you think there'll be more things like the Pirate Party is doing, or will there be more political communication like we've seen in the U.S. during this election cycle? Thank you.
Thank you. I think we're moving over to this way in the back, please.
Adnan Muminovic, I'm an intern at the Heinrich Pell Foundation here in DC, and I'm originally from Sarajevo, from Bosnia and Herzegovina. And I have one question. Last week there was this joint visit from Secretary Clinton and Catherine Ashton to Sarajevo, Belgrade, and Pristina, and there have been a lot of different analysis from the media, ranging from this is some sort of, has a symbolic meaning that the United States are withdrawing from the Balkans and putting everything in the hands of the EU. On the other side, it was supposed to mean a new transatlantic approach towards the Balkans. I have personally some problems understanding what this visit might have really meant, so I would like to ask and hear your opinion about it. If the US is really leaving the Balkans to the EU, and if the EU can handle it. I unfortunately am a little bit skeptic about it, but I would like to hear your opinion. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you. Just want to make sure we have it now. We have the demographic crisis and babies, pivot, and what that means transatlantically, the Arab awakening transatlantically. We have how to make the social media internet more hip and happening politically in Germany, and Lady Ashton and Secretary Clinton's marvelous road trip to the Balkans. In 10 minutes or less, have at it, Carter. I told you these guys would be tough. I told you.
This is what I call a challenge.
Yeah.
I start with the last one again.
You're going to go backwards. Okay.
Because it's probably could still combine the baby issue with many of the things.
Okay. You'll tie it all together.
But, it was a transatlantic approach at the beginning. And I think we should not risk the success story parts we see in it by denying it as a transatlantic approach. And it was clear since many, many years now that Europe should take over step by step. We have had this Berlin Plus arrangements and other things, and then after a certain period, it was actually supposed to happen that way, with many difficulties, of course, and drawbacks again and again. And to be honest, I'm also not too happy to look at Bosnia-Herzegovina at the very moment. I still see problems we have been discussing for years as well. Maybe the constitution, maybe the police sector, maybe. So we've had that. But nevertheless, I think it is a necessity that the European Union takes care of that. And it has to prove its ability to be a decisive factor in its very neighborhood with potential members. I just was pointing at the Thessaloniki goals before, so it should be it should be possible, and I think we shouldn't lower the expectations, but actually ask for a clear engagement in this regard. And I actually like the idea that Cathy Ashton and Hillary Clinton did it together. I would like to see them more often on other places in this world, and so maybe it could serve as an example. On the communication and the internet, well, the Pirate Party in Germany is suffering at the moment, let's say that way, and I think it will continue to suffer for quite a while to come, because they now finally realize that hitting political structural realities and the initial point of doing it entirely different can have its limits. And I don't see too many characters within the Pirates Party right now which stand for an idea that immediately will be overwhelmed, excuse the word, by a shitstorm of the own party members. Mm-hmm. And this is how it's called in the meanwhile, if you get the opinion of the respective members of the party as such. But that's not only this kind of storm. Some others may experience as well. I've had my experiences too. but the communication in the communication factor as such, I think, and I can only say it from my perspective, I have very, very long highly underestimated how intense the political discussion is within the internet and the platforms and the social media that are offered in the meanwhile, and how archaically we sometimes still react on that very development. I think there's some segments over here which are much further ahead already than we are in Europe or maybe also in Germany. Those are lessons we have to learn. On the other hand, I am also very much in favor of not only having it there and where everybody could hide behind anonymity, and where the tone reaches a certain level which you actually would not like to see your children share every single hour. So it's it will be a hard thing to juggle with, but we need to do it. It's because otherwise we don't reach out to them any longer. Stephen, that's a hard and a big question on the Arab Spring. And I said something before on the expectations after the Cairo speech. I think it was an excellent speech. I'm not one of those who would blame the president for also, we call it apologizing, or we call it differently, but to give them a feeling that there is a different way of expressing yourself and a different way of taking care from the American side, and which is not only understood as being dominated or as being paternalized or whatever. So I think the impulses as such were good. I just missed, a follow-up after that was somehow measurable. And I think Secretary Clinton did a rather impressive job by traveling there again and again and again, but the narrative after the Cairo speech somehow vanished. And I may have not followed it precisely enough, but I read a lot, and I couldn't find it. And that, I think, made it even more difficult to play a credible role in this Arab Spring, which has now shifted in a rather intense Arab winter already, and to find a balanced role or situation for the United States, but also for the European Union. In the European Union, we have a traditional problem of more involved southern member states, or Mediterranean member states. And I take your point, as many of the Maghreb states are looking up to Turkey right now and say, well, this could be, but some of them, this could be a model for us. And this is maybe a way of how to develop and of not having too much dependencies to certain regions in the world and to other things, that linking our approaches with Turkey is, in my opinion, a key factor also for understanding what's going on there. And then we have to be very careful not to generalize. So that's one of the things where the tendency is over here, and there are tendencies in Europe as well. We talk about the Maghreb states, we talk about the Arab Spring, we talk, and we, you certainly don't, but many do. It's and we don't make the differentiation and and don't realize the fragmentation within these countries and other things as well. It's in this internet, and that's maybe a link to your question as well. One of the keys as well of how to come to a solution there is to find a way of outreach via modern media, modern forms of communication. And there we have so many approaches all over the world, from the American side, from the European Union, where I try to give advice in foreign affairs questions as well, from other member states of the European Union as such. Is there any coordination? No. We try to build it up now. It's so incredibly hard. What's the outcome? You even put the activists even more at risk, because if you come from 9, 10, 11 directions, the easiest thing is just to track them. And then they are more or less on the silver tray. And so that's also a thing we have to see in combination here. Turkey is certainly a key factor. I think it is. And last point to that, what we need to improve on the transatlantic level is exchange of information. This is one of the things which I clearly see now in this job I'm doing for the European Union. But when it comes to the Maghreb, there is so much information gathering on the European side and on the American side. But the exchange could be lifted much. The exchange factor could be lifted much higher. And there we have to work on that. I think that absolutely that's one of the points. For Marsha, maybe just the question is big. But maybe 2 points. I think as long as we are seeing us in Europe with our strengths within the national member states in this spectrum, we will give also the Chinese just a blank check of how to play with that. And so our factor to be influential and to also somehow combine the economic strength we could have to also put on the table when it comes to tough question is somehow limited in this regard. So we have one thing I think we have from our point of view, and I was part of that, we haven't had certain developments in the Far East for us from a European perspective now, in the Trans-Pacific sphere from here, we didn't have it on our screen for a very long time. And we were somehow reluctant to be a major factor there. And not only a major factor when it came to economic chances and possibilities, but also in political terms, in exchange of views with iffy questions as such. And the second factor, I think it's not only us and it's not only the US and the inability to combine our efforts. I think it's also a very sophisticated way by China of how to give us the impression that the other part is actually not part of our thinking. And they know how to do that. It's so easy and somehow understandable from a national perspective from their side. I think we should work a little bit more on that and try to analyze that much more thoroughly as we do at the moment. And demographic developments. I always asked for a highly simplistic and almost naive thing as a first point. And that's a stock-taking that comes to a moment to tell the people the truth. Everybody in Germany, almost every family in Germany knows that there is a problem. Because they just have to look around with the demographic development. Almost everybody can link that to a potential time bomb when it comes to the social security systems. That's understandable for everybody, and that's actually one thing you can easily phrase. And of course, the closer we come to elections, the harder it is to speak it out. And the promises when it comes to the pensions and to retirement, all the things, we've heard that before. But I think the first step would be a clear stock-taking. And based on that, we need to get our hands on our systems, on our social systems, because otherwise we are doomed to implode. And the examples you have given from Sweden and from France, well, one also has to see that is connected with a domestic narrative you need to phrase as well, because many of the families that have more children than the 1 point, I don't know what, I still have problems to deal with 1 point so many children, are families that are second or third generation immigrants. And with that, of course, other follow-up questions are connected. So bringing these factors together is probably one of the biggest challenges for policymakers right now in Europe, and one that urgently needs openness. And this openness we have to allow ourselves as people, as voters on one hand, but the government needs to do the same. Thank you.
Carl Theodor, thank you so much. What a tour de force. An hour and a half of important conversation, big issues, big challenges, big opportunities. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for spending your afternoon with us. Please join us again.